evening, we have the honor of sharing in two people's lives and a deep sense of understanding a major part of their lives, a place where they spend, I'm sure, more than 40 hours a week, judging from having talked to one of them about his endeavors earlier in this week. It's really an honor to be able to have people who are willing to share at least parts of their work-faith journey so that we can all come to understand more about them and also perhaps about the issues involved in connecting faith with work and also about our own journeys. So, I'm really looking forward. I have heard little bits and pieces, but I'm looking forward to this very much. I've asked Steve Boyd, who works for Boeing, to go first. And there will be ample time for questions and discussions. And so please, I'm going to ask them to give a little bit of a story and develop some continuity with talking about their lives. But we will have time, plenty of time for questions and discussion. It's all yours.
Thank you. This is frightening. It's frightening because I've been asked to talk about something that I usually reserve to talk about with my closest friends, kind of in privacy. But having worshiped with you, I feel like at least you're my friends now, even though I don't know you very well. To talk about my faith journey is kind of strange, because I have never really thought about it that way. But you need to know I'm a sinner. And now having talked to the Swaggerts and the Bakers, I know at least I'm in good company. But we're all sinners. And we're sinners that are in a community. And it's because we're in community that we can share and live. And if we are not in some sort of community, we really can't live. So we saw a picture earlier today of an apple with a worm in it. I'm reminded that maybe sometimes I'm that worm in the apple. At the same time, I'm part of the rest of that whole picture, which is all of the body of Christ. So bear with me. I'm 40 years old almost, going to have a birthday pretty soon. I went to college in Tacoma, got a degree in physics, fell in love with a beautiful woman, and she chose to marry me when I asked. I also unfortunately was drafted because I had the privilege of graduating from college when the Vietnam War was at part of its peak. So instead of joining the Army, which was my government's first choice for me, I joined the Navy in order to avoid walking to my war, and was given an opportunity to volunteer for lots of different kinds of services when you're already there, you know. So I chose to go into explosive ordnance disposal. I decided that if I had to be there and I didn't choose to run away or be a conscientious objector, I'd try to do something that wouldn't hurt people if possible. So I learned how to take bombs apart, usually broken ones. And I never killed myself doing it, as you can see, and I managed to keep other people from being hurt by doing a fairly responsible job of taking ordnance that was damaged or destroyed or in a fire and getting rid of it. Well, when I was on a flight deck of an aircraft carrier off the coast of Vietnam, a fighter bomber came back in with a fused bomb that he couldn't get rid of. And in the middle of a blinding storm, I had to go out and defuse the bomb because they couldn't move the aircraft and they couldn't bring any more in until that one had been fixed. It was sort of in the way. And then the guy who was guiding the aircraft didn't see that I was out there on the starboard, on the outboard side, and he told his pilot to get his airplane out of the way so the rest of them could land. And so there I was, hanging on to the outside of this thing in a storm. And I lived. I sort of had a religious experience. I also woke up my wife, who was several thousand miles away. Well, when I got out of the Navy, Mary asked me, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "Well, I don't know for sure, but I think I want to try to go to seminary." So I went to Wesley Seminary in Washington, D.C., because I'd spent some time in training in the area anyway. And I spent 3 years at Wesley Theological Seminary and then discovered the ministry, the formal ministry, was not my place. It wasn't my vocation, though I didn't know what to do yet. And my best friend, whose apartment was right down from me, said, "Steve, I have a good friend, he's my brother-in-law, who is looking for crazy people that are honest." And I said, "I know I'm crazy and I think I'm honest. Let me go talk to the guy." And it turns out he was working for a company called Science Applications Incorporated at the Office of the Secretary of Defense for Strategic and Theater Nuclear Weapons Analysis. And they were looking for weapons systems analysts to help decide which weapon systems to build or in which order to build them and rank order the priority of the things that were going to be built. This was while Jimmy Carter was in office. And so I joined that group. And I worked with them analyzing chemical weapons, the use of chemical weapons, nuclear weapons and their use, to rank order the relative utility or the usefulness or the military usefulness of weapon systems. I did that there for 3 years before I came to work for Boeing. I've been doing weapon systems analysis in Boeing ever since, helping to, I hope, try to make this thing a little less stupid. I can't make it go away. Like when I was drafted, I couldn't run away from that. And I can't make it not happen by wishing it so, but I like to think sometimes I can help make it a little less stupid. So I've been doing that kind of thing ever since. Part of the faith journey, though, is to work with people and treat them as people, to work with the people that are around me and beside me and treat them with the respect that they deserve for the work they're doing. And I'd like to say that what I try to do is to try to be faithful in some of the small things as much as I possibly can, simply to maintain a core of a place where I can be faithful. And then I drag up every once in a while the responsibility, the awesome responsibility of deciding, is what am I doing right now really the thing I should be doing? Quite independent of how well I am doing it. I happen to think I'm a very good analyst, and I happen to think I work very well with the people beside me. And I think doing my job well, like creating anything else, is part of one of God's requests of me. Now the question is the job I'm doing well right now the one I'm supposed to be doing at all? So what I'm doing here this evening is not telling you what the answer is, but telling you that's part of my search to try to solve that problem too. I could go on for hours, but I have one quick thing to say. I was at the Pentagon when the Vietnam War was winding down, and there was a huge rally, and they had people circling the Pentagon all the way around holding hands, and they came in all the entrances and they jammed up all the things. People were climbing over rows and rows of bodies to try to get to work, and the policemen were hauling them out of the way as fast as they could. And I went on in and I told my boss, I said, "Hey, Paul, what's going on out there anyway? What's happening? Why is it that we see our jobs so radically different, that these people are volunteering their blood to each other so they can get a cup of it, so they can go throw it against the wall of the Pentagon? What's going on?" And he said, "Steve, everybody has to see what needs to be done from a different place. I like to think of it as there's a bus full of kids going down a steep hill, and somebody looks up and sees there's no driver in the bus, but it's going down a hill. And some people get out and jump in front and say, 'Hey, bus, stop,' and it smacks them and just goes right on down the hill anyway. But it lets other people see that that's what's happening. And if you can, you try to jump onto the bus and then get up in the driver's seat and slam on the brake. And if there's no brakes, at least you try to steer to hit something soft." Well, that's where I am. That's where I am in my journey. And thank you for letting me share it.
I would like us to feelings, and encourage us to pair up and check in with how we're feeling, what we just heard, and give Steve a chance to move through this. So, and also, if you want, talk a little bit about what your questions might be. So pair up with people next to you, if you would.
I forget how powerful it is. Thank you for letting us. It's fun to do the work. It's, there's a group of people for whom these kinds of questions are
together.
I would like to entertain questions about or suggestions or statements or wherever you are. It's equally valid to go.
Yeah, and I'd also encourage us to follow Steve's lead and be able to talk not just about the ideas involved, but about the gut level feelings of get stirred up and look at questions like this. Even if some of those feelings might be seemingly in conflict, they are simply a question of sharing where we are. So whatever you wish to share, welcome. Somebody has to start.
Do others that you work with feel as you do the concern?
I think so. There's a group of people in my immediate area for whom this is a concern, and we talk about it at fairly regular intervals. Several of them expressed a strong desire to be able to come to this, but unfortunately had prior family commitments or something else that made them not able to come to this tonight. I was hoping to have some of my own coworkers here tonight. We weren't able to make it. But yeah, it's the kind of things we do is not something you can just not think about. People come down in entirely different political perspectives where I am, from incredibly conservative to incredibly liberal. But yeah, it's of concern that what we do is what it is. Is a very important concern for some people.
I have a question. I don't really know what lobbying or what being a weapons analyst means, but I guess the part that's hard for me about the defense industry is the lobbying that goes on by companies. I'm most familiar in Minneapolis, where I'm from, with Honeywell, but lobbying for more defense expenditures, lobbying for more weapons systems. And that's where the school bus analogy is. I mean, that was really powerful. I never thought of that as if there's no brakes trying to steer it to hit something soft. That's really powerful. But actually, some of the companies are trying to make the school bus go faster in ways. What, do you have any influence on the lobbying, or what do you, how do you deal with that?
I have no influence on the lobbying per se.
What does a weapons analyst do then? How do you decide what systems are good and what aren't?
I help design and understand the environment in which an airplane would fly. What kind of weapons would be used to shoot it down? Where would they be? How would they be used? And then how would we build our jet airplane to survive in that environment? It has nothing to do with the shape of the airplane per se, but the requirement for it to go at a certain speed, or to be able to turn at a certain rate, or carry a certain kind of weapon of its own so that it could survive in that environment. And we do it all with computer simulations, of course. So part of the trick is to understand what we think the threat is, wherever we think the threat would be, and then design the cheapest possible airplane to survive in that threat and break things and kill people somewhere else, in the hopes that that weapon doesn't have to be used to break things and kill people somewhere else. And then back to the lobbying question. When I was at the Pentagon, when I was working, the lobbying aside, one of my tasks was to read the reports that came from Honeywell, or came from Litton, or came from Boeing, and look at the conclusion on the back page, which was the given, and then look at the introductory statements and the basic assumptions up front that were what they listed, said that this is what we know and here's our conclusion, to see if there's really a connection. And if I couldn't find the connection, to figure out what the assumptions were they had to have to come to the conclusion they did. And then when you send the report back saying, if you said you needed one of these or one of those, then you had to have implied that this was what was important. And you didn't believe that when you started. Rewrite your report or change your conclusion. So you had to get through the advertising hype of what it was, analyze what the weapon could do, and then back up to what it was you were supposed to believe in order to do that. An example was a weapon system that was a very small nuclear bomb that would tunnel under the ground and blow up underground and make a big crater with practically no fallout and practically no residual radiation that got into the air, but just made gorgeous holes in the ground. Technically, it was just almost impossible to build, but there are people who really wanted to work on it because it would stress their technical capabilities to build this weapon so that it could come off at the Pershing into the ground at incredibly high speed, survive long enough to blow up underground and make a big crater somewhere. And they said they'd use it to stop the enemy from coming forward. And so they really had to have it, because if they broke those bridges and broke those things over there, then the enemy couldn't get his troops and his supplies forward to the front line. What they left out of the assumption was we have a treaty that we have promised to agree to, as have the Soviets, that in the war we will not use tactical weapons inside major cities. And there are almost no bridges in Europe that are not inside major cities. So they left out that whole piece of the analysis that says the weapon can't be used where you have designed it to be most useful. So we were able to kill that particular weapon system from being built in the first place. The guys who wanted to build it left out of the analysis the fact that there were no viable targets. And if you didn't read the report back up into what was supposed to have happened and then put that back in again, the weapon would not have been canceled. That's an example to try to answer your question. The lobbying happens more on the political side, and I haven't nearly as much control over that.
It's unfortunate we don't have a lobbyist here. I just want to say I'm with you. I really appreciate what you said and the courage you took to say it. And one thing I had a question about is, here you are, trying to stop this bus, or at least try and put it in a direction where it's going to do the least amount of harm for everyone. And you're trying, and let's take the analogy a little bit further. Say you're trying to get into the Pentagon to do your job, and the Pentagon is the bus or whatever. And here you're faced with a line of Christian protesters who are going to basically throw everything at you that they possibly can, including maybe blood or whatever it is. Where do you go to get your support to do what you do? I mean, I struggle because I don't know where to go into church for people to understand what I do and support it. A lot of people understand the issue real well, but almost nobody understands what I'm trying to do, and I think what you're trying to do, Steve. So, you know, you had mentioned a group or whatever. I guess I'm just real curious to find out where you go.
I have a pastor at my church now that supports me. She does so by preaching well, by sharing with us the responsibility of being, of trying to be faithful. I don't have many supporters inside the church who understand what I'm trying to do. I feel like that is a faith journey that's essentially happening separated from the church. But without that community of people at Kennedale United Methodist Church, where I go, that support me in the rest of the things about being in the community, not being inside the church, but on stances of apartheid, when our bishops wrote a letter on in defense of creation, United Methodist Church bishops wrote a letter on in defense of creation and suggested, nay, they recommended, told us to read the letter from the pulpit and then study it. We did a study series in our church, and several of our more conservative members just refused to even come, to even address the question at all. And then others were quite responsive to the fact that there's lots of ways to look at the problem, lots of ways to understand it. But in the main, I don't feel I get much support in the church in the problem I'm trying to do. Maybe because I'm wrong.
I still don't understand what you were trying to do or what your strategy is. Not clear.
My strategy is to say, if a weapon is going to be built, if I can't pull the curtain and stop the entire weapon system industrial complex, at least those things that are built are functional, that they're not bought in order to fill a political hole, and that they're not sold in order simply to make a profit, but that those weapons that are built perform the function they're supposed to, so that they not be used in the first place, and that they're not just expensive pieces of fluff that don't do anything at all. In one of the studies that I worked on, which I think was very important, was it was addressing what do we do if the Soviets attempt to use nuclear weapons on the United States, and then we have a long-term retaliatory capability. So we start scrapping MX-type missiles, and we start scrapping some of the submarine-type missiles that are incredibly accurate and incredibly fast, and make the other person have to react very rapidly. Once these missiles that we have, at least the ground-based missiles, start to be launched, there's practically no time for the Soviets to react, one, to see if it's a mistake, or two, to see if it's just bad information that's coming in. Because if they don't react very quickly, then they have no choice. They have to react now, and then it becomes an Armageddon. If you design weapons that are sure to arrive and slow to arrive, then that implies that there's lots of time for the correct decisions to be made, if the weapons are going to be built anyway. So I've helped design some of the weapons that are slower and more sure, so that we have confidence that we're able to nuke them until they blow. But at the same time, they don't inspire a disconcerting feeling on the other side that they will be nuked before they have a chance to think about it. If we're going to retaliate, then we have to have the capability to understand what it is we're going to, why it is, and what it is we're going to retaliate about. So designing into weapons that survive is a surveillance capability, not to surveil the Soviet Union, but to surveil the United States. After most of our modern communication system is gone, how do we decide how to retaliate if we want to retaliate in kind? And that really becomes a doctrine. Then you build survivable airplanes that also look at the United States to see what damage was done, if you really want to say we have the capability to do a tit for tat. So that's a design requirement for a kind of an airplane, to survive, to look at the United States, to act as a control system, and then to go make an appropriate response if we've decided that's our policy to do so. And I've helped with that.
Seems like with nuclear weapons that we're talking about, it seems like the stakes are so
high. Speak up a little, please.
With nuclear weapons, the stakes are so high, so in some ways it seems like we're just propagating. So it seems like these weapon systems are a lot different than weapon systems before because of the stakes that are involved. So,
very much so. Part of the doctrine I've tried to help build is to say every weapon system which, if employed, doesn't cause escalation but is designed to reduce the level of conflict. So if you've built it, if you've designed it so that if it is used, it's part of the reduction of the level of conflict, then things that are being built are what draws the fight down rather than making it bigger. And sometimes you can influence it with that kind of policy, and sometimes you can't. But if you build things in certain ways, the only thing they do is increase the level of conflict. A tripwire system, which what I think the MX is a classic example of that. It only works one way. If you don't use it within the next 30 minutes, they will all be gone. So you have to use them right now. And that doesn't reduce the level of conflict. That makes it much, much worse. But alternates are being thought about, including non-nuclear alternates, to allow you to do that. And I'm part of helping make that happen sometimes.
What about Star Wars, SDI?
I think it's an expensive pig in a poke. I really do. But I haven't had a whole hell of a lot of influence over it. For that to work implies such a large amount of money to be spent that it would essentially gut the economy.
Why does President Reagan put such confidence in it?
That's not a fair question, because I'm not thinking sure you're talking about a person for whom logic helps a lot.
Question back there?
Yes, Steve, I guess I have a reaction, and I appreciate too very much what you've shared and where you're at, and I guess I've come to see that everyone does have a different role in the complexity of this issue. I guess for myself personally, I've dealt with this issue coming to it with a lot of anger, with a lot of impatience, with a lot of just anger, and I think I've worked through some of that. I've come to see more and understand that each person is called differently. But I guess I still must have a little bit of anger in me, because I'm noticing that your analogy on the school bus is just rubbing me the wrong way. Although when you initially said it struck a chord in me, I'm realizing right now that if we carry the analogy out, it's almost like the people in the school bus were assuming then that they have no control of what's going on, that they're just helpless children, like the analogy it says, that they're helpless, and none of them is going to jump up and get in the driver's seat themselves, because they're all they're all just totally helpless. And I mean, the analogy really is whoever is in the school bus in this particular, you know, relating it to this issue is not at all helpless. And they are the ones, in fact, that should be jumping up, because they might have even been the mischievous kids that told the bus driver that they forgot something and then slipped off the emergency brake to have fun, have a good ride. I mean, excuse
sure.
me for sticking my neck out.
No,
but
no.
I think that the
I
analogy,
appreciate that.
The analogy was just making me realize, though, that the people really, all of us are responsible for this, and we all need to deal with it in a different way, but the people in the bus are not really helpless, and they're not really, you know, just totally...
Well, I would almost have to say that the people on the bus are all of us. And also, all of us are outside watching the bus go by, all at the same time. But each of us has to jump on somewhere and make a statement, particularly about weapons of war and how we deal with each other. And if you're already inside the bus, because we are already inside the bus, you have to stand up and make your statement where it is, where you can. So I appreciate your speaking to the inadequacy of the model. Yet we're the same foolish people on the school bus as we are on the outside watching it go by.
I hear you talk about this support group you have.
Oh, it's a bunch of us that get together and talk about it. It's certainly nothing formal.
I guess I'm curious about your immediate work environment, these other analysts that you're working with, and in particular talk about this faith journey here. In what ways do you act as a challenge to your immediate work environment in presenting ethical, moral, a spiritual dimension to these otherwise real technical questions?
Well, we're not technical people. We're people there who also work technical issues. My coworker who sits beside me had a SIDS death last year. And he's crushed. And he's still crushed. And we visit about that. I'm one of the places where he can talk about it, because I'm at work, but I'm also familiar with some of the kinds of problems. And it gives him a place to talk, so that we develop a trust that's independent of our having technical competence together. Because it's a place where he can break down a little and say, hey, I'm really feeling sad today. I have not yet resolved the fact that my one-year-old just died in the crib. So we're not just technical people. We share together I think I'm very lucky. I'm working with a group of incredibly intelligent people, very competent people, who are concerned about the kind of life they want to lead, the kind of life they are leading, and where they're going. And we share that concern too, as well as our technical competence. So it's hard to express my response very well, I guess.
And how does that carry over into the decision making? You talk about this doctrine that you're working towards. How does that faith sharing on the job carry over into some kind of collective shaping of that doctrine?
Oh, okay. Well, the faith sharing isn't explicit God talk. That's the important thing to say. Okay. It's sharing a concern that human beings are responsible for each other. It's sharing a concern that human beings actually count. Now, how do we resolve that fact that human beings are responsible for each other and count in the kinds of things we're doing? So it isn't to say that it's necessary for my company or their company to make a quarterly profit by building what we build. It's also necessary to say we're building these for a longer term goal. And part of that goal is to shape the technologies that are going to be bought in the subsequent years towards that kind of goal. And when I wrote it up and passed it on to my bosses, it's a reasonable goal. To build a weapon which, if you've got to build it, has embedded in its design trying to bring the war down instead of trying to trigger and make the war bigger. And reasonable people cannot disagree that that's an important thing to do. But if you don't think about it, then you don't have that embedded in the technologies you try to design.
Mom.
Yes, sir?
Yeah, I wrestle with this whole
whole business of, you know, the arms escalation too. And I also wrestle with the idea that human nature being what it is, and I think you said it earlier, we're sinners. That somehow or another, maybe all of us, certainly all of us here, I agree that war is hell, you might say, and that it'd be nice if we wouldn't have to even cope with that. And I guess I'm wondering whether sometimes a lot of people don't live with this reality that there are people who are going to start wars or try to do something in this world that isn't. I mean, that's been sort of the history of the world, in a sense. And I guess I'm thinking of the historical perspective as well, but I was in World War II, which was not as difficult conscience-wise as Vietnam War, although it was difficult, but at the same time, how do you balance reality with idealism? You know, I guess that's what I'm saying.
One of my best friends, who's a minister in the Methodist Church, is a strong advocate of civilian-based defense. He said, let's get ourselves a Department of War and call it a Department of War, not a Department of Defense. Let's get ourselves a Department of Defense and build a civilian-based defense where, with goodwill and with absolute candor and with the ability to lay down your life if you're going to get killed by doing that, go ahead and meet the enemy at the beach when he shows up, and then choose to never do what he tells you to, even if it costs you your life. And then pretty soon he'll get discouraged and go home. And indeed, that's what Gandhi tried to do in India. Pretty soon the British simply could not put up with the fact that these people simply won't follow the rules and went home. I'm not convinced that that works against madmen, and I'm not convinced it works against weapons of war where you kill each other from long distances. You don't get a chance to put a flower in a guy's rifle when he's shooting at you from a very long distance away. And if millions of people die in a nuclear war or millions of people die in a civilian-based defense, it's kind of a moot point one way or the other, I guess. So he and I have come down in entirely different places about how one defends oneself against mad men and mad women with weapons of war. And that's about the best I can do to respond to your question.
You know, I'm glad that there are people like yourself in positions like what you're in. And I was just talking with Jeanette earlier. I said, you know, I come from a totally different perspective on this issue. I used to be part of a community like this, and I still hold a lot of the pacifist values very dearly. Even though I'm involved in defense-related industries. But, you know, I tell you, when it comes down to the final hour, if there's going to be one, I want a Christian in that silo. I want someone who thinks about these issues behind that button. I want someone who wrestles like Steve wrestles behind that button. And it's so easy for me to think, no, a Christian doesn't belong there. How could a Christian be in a missile silo? How could a Christian contemplate pushing a button that would kill millions and billions of people? It's really easy for me to say that, but on the other hand, that's where I want the Christian to be. And, you know, sometimes I think we look at this in a real narrow perspective. I think we get caught up in wrestling with what's right and wrong. And we don't see what our responsibilities are. Or we define our responsibilities much too simply.
there are other ways to deal with this issue than marching in a protest. There are other ways to creatively and constructively and with Christ in your heart deal with this.
I was at the Space Systems Command about a year and a half ago dealing with some of the issues of putting weapons in orbit and talking about some of the responsibilities involved in that and some of the kinds of communications facilities and computer types that would be implied by putting weapons in orbit, and convinced some people that that kind of weapon system had to be reconsidered very, very carefully before you'd even think about it, and talked about some of the technological implications of doing that. And we sort of backed down on some projects. And then when I got outside in front of the Space Defense Command, there was a group of women there who were carrying a sign, who come every day, they trade off, to the Space Command to say, listen, you shouldn't be doing this. And I walked up to one and winked and said, well, some of us are working the problem from the inside too.
Yeah, you both are essential. You've got to have both.
I was just concerned about timer, so that we could hear both sides of the story. Is there a certain time limit for getting each person?
I was concerned about that too. We've got plenty of time left, so.
How long were we getting?
We're going to 29, so okay. We've got quite a while left.
Another question to follow up on that one about your comment about there's different ways to work. Do you find it unhelpful that there are protesters, that Christians that have chosen to take that course of action? And what would you like to see the church more involved in that would be more supportive of your vision for disarming the world?
Wow, that's a good question. I too have gone over to the submarine locks and stood on the tracks, protested, and then come home again. Went with my family, as a matter of fact. Hunthausen was there, along with the rest of the big guys.
Along with the photographers.
Yeah, along with the photographers, sure. I'm surprised I haven't lost my clearance yet. But I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know.
But you don't find the fact that so many church people are involved in protest against your company, for example, that doesn't seem to undermine you or to undermine your faith in others?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think it's kind of interesting. I think it's important it helps bring the light to some people's eyes that there's other sides to the issue. I haven't seen it at much at Boeing, but when I was at the Pentagon after some of these big protests that took place there, you know, the light colonels and the majors were talking to each other, walking down the halls, about what it was these people were trying to say. They weren't just saying, let's get that trash out of the way so we can go back to the business of making war. It was, let's talk about some of the issues they were bringing up. So it impacts people. And I'm not to say that that kind of protest doesn't impact people or shouldn't happen. I think it should happen. But I also know that if it's done without an analysis of an understanding of the problem, if you just bring your emotions to the table without knowing any of the consequences of what it is you're attempting to do, it also isn't very valuable in and of itself.
Thank you very much.
Can I get off the hot seat now? Move over to the side.
My name is Tom Donnelly. I am 53. To put it in context, I was born in 35 and went through grade school corresponding to the 40s, 1940 and 41, I was in the first grade. and so forth. And I spent the first 8 years in a Catholic parochial school. I come from the completely typical Catholic family background. If there is a stereotype in the background, it would be me. I went to the Catholic parochial school. My growing up, my vision of, say, fourth grade is, I think we probably had three priests in the parish, and it seems like an enormous number of nuns. But standing on the front stairs to the school with the local bomb marshals, but in any event, the officials accepting a big check from a parishioner and turning in gold and buying war bonds and all the martial music and all the support for war, all kinds together, all with Christian soldiers, stars and stripes, collared priests and nuns, and in other words, I could not possibly distinguish where Jesus was in this group. I mean, it was all the same thing to me, just simply red, white, and blue God. So it didn't get much better for me in high school. I went to a private Catholic boys' school. And I should also tell you that I lived in a house that was only one house away from the grounds of Andover Theological Seminary. I could, no, it was a lawn yard, and I can't throw that word.
I can see it from where I work. I was talking to him on the phone, and I could see the school where he went.
Well, that seminary was there. And I would ask my parents, what is that? Nobody knew, no one that I was growing up with knew what it was, because it definitely wasn't Catholic. Whatever else was happening up there was something terrible was going on up there. And part of why it was terrible was that there was inquiry up there. And the Catholics had that solved. They simply didn't need any more inquiry. We had a way of doing things. It came down, and there it all was wrapped up in a neat rule book. And so as long as we did that rule book, we were fine. And what in the world are those people still inquiring about? We already have the answers. And I knew that by the time I was in the fifth grade. So I went to 1 year of a private Catholic college where I attended Mass daily. At least I think we were supposed to, but it might have been on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays that half of us went. Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays the other half went. I'm not sure what day I was assigned, but definitely was there and attendance was taken. And I had a strange religion taught to me, really, this whole time, that there was an awful lot to be said for memorizing it. I can remember, for instance, that a test given in college, now this is getting up there, religion course had much more to do, did I know the chronological history of Jesus' public life, the chronology of it. The test involved all the events and then putting them in chronological order. And this was taught by a brilliant priest who also figured out how to grade it. So if you got one thing wrong, you better get another thing wrong to get you back into the right cycle. Otherwise, all of the subsequent answers could be wrong. This is a time of Korean War and draft and ROTC, and there simply was no alternative available, simply available, to not be in war, not to be drafted. And after 1 year there, I had some discipline problems there, and I encountered some abuse of authority in that college. Mm-hmm. I went on to the Naval Academy, where at least I knew the discipline would be by the rule book. There was a certain punishment for a certain rule breaking. And that coincided a lot more with my more fundamental Catholicism. I'd say I came out of the Naval Academy in 1957 without a single pacifist bone. Probably not even a single pacifist hair. And there was still a red, white, and blue God. Probably 4 years later, I was on a ship in the South China Sea. And that would be in 61, in that time frame. We had a few people come on board ship who were military advisors in Southeast Asia. They had been there since World War II. They were all officers at this time. I don't think that they were when they were first serving there, but they had remained and married there and had families there. They came to talk to us for about an hour, and they stayed all day talking to the officers in the wardroom on the ship. We would let them go away. We had too many questions for them. And it came down to that we really couldn't win a war in Southeast Asia, was the analysis of the people who were there. And if we couldn't do it because we differed from the people who lived there with our concept of time and probably also of place. And it was the first time I had ever even entertained that kind of concept or idea. That, you know, they just were very different people. What we might expect to happen in a week or a month, they would be perfectly content to wait generations. And that the place for some of them was this small little town for all of their lives. And our place would be the whole planet, if not the universe. And so it was totally different. But the idea that we couldn't win there, a war, was, I couldn't understand it. I could understand what they were saying to me, but the fact that America couldn't win a war, America, red, white, and blue, Jesus couldn't win a war, that was, I probably couldn't abide that. No, God's on our side. But it started me questioning it, and on board ship, I'd say from that day on, I was probably changed to an idea of, if we can't win here, if these are the people who know the area, then why are we kind of preparing for a war here? And why do I think America is always right? Why in every history course I've ever taken has America been right? I mean, that's not right. That's something wrong with that idea and with a lot of my background. And I probably changed from then on to being a much more inquiring, a much less, a person much less ready to accept the conventional answer. I went to MIT for 3 years and observed the conflict grow in Vietnam. with a brother-in-law, we wrote a few letters to congressmen saying something's very wrong here. We can't win. That's my feeling from talking to some people who were there. Do you know? Do you talk to anybody? We couldn't get a response. And so for a while, we decided if we knew there was going to be war there and no one else did, maybe there's a way to make money out of it. That simply knowing that was going to happen, there must be some place to put it to use in this great capitalist system. He built apartment houses, and I was involved with one of them with him. But that was one way of looking at the problem. We simply were getting nowhere with congressmen writing a letter saying, you know, sooner or later someone in your district is going to be killed, or some tan. Does it make any difference? Do you have to wait until then? And I'd say in my associations at the time, I was quite public with the way I felt about what was happening in Vietnam. I went to the Boston Naval Shipyard, and the Vietnam War continued to grow. With a lot of bad stories coming back from people who were on ship and participating in the war. We had a few mutinies, and they were all engendered by probably enlisted men protesting on board ship. A lot of stories that are never published. A cruiser, we did a lot of shelling of the beaches. And one day, and in order to do that, you have to rearm at night and fire your bullets in the daytime, or vice versa. But it's the same people. I mean, they're in the gun mount of turret firing the bullets, or they're picking up the bullets as they come aboard from the other ship, carrying them to an elevator, stowing them away in a magazine. There's not much sleep. People were understandably tired, and when the reports come back in from the spotters on the beach, we don't have any targets, and the ships continue to fire the bullets. There are at least some people on board who say, you know, we shouldn't be doing this. And some of them went into the brig, and they said, we'd much rather be in the brig because it beats 22 hours a day of working, when it's to no avail. It doesn't take very many stories like that to add to a growing awareness that there's something very wrong with this war. I'd say about, I left there, and we left from Boston Shipyard, we went to the Philippines to get a whole lot closer to it and hear more of the same stories. My particular work in here was in the shipyard fixing ships, and really the same thing in the Philippines. The ships break down. They are incredibly complicated mechanical devices, and even though we were really fighting an unopposed war in Vietnam, as far as big ships, Blue Water Navy ships were concerned, we really had two navies. We had a Brown Water Navy, which was small boats in the rivers, and a Blue Water Navy, which was the big ships at sea. The Brown Water Navy was opposed 24 hours a day, the big ships never. But they still break down, and we had to have a continuing repair capability in the Subic Bay. And we spent, when I say we, a couple of other people shared my views that this really was a crazy war, but we were involved and didn't seem to be able to find a nice way out. We're dealing with national pride. We're dealing with what should be a pushover opposition. And how can we abide not winning? And we weren't winning. And the ships would break down, but the result was a lot of stories would come in, and a lot of people talk to each other. And I'd say the awareness of that war was growing among my friends who were fixing ships and the other people too who were sailing. I came back from there to a job inspecting ships, new ships and old ones, operating out of Washington, D.C. I went to a Center for Naval Analysis where I was a resident naval architect for a few years. And it's possible in all of these jobs to talk to real people all the time and express your views, see, about what's happening. Why are we continuing to do this? And not, and what seems a little bit strange now, to not feel a compulsion to leave that system. There is enough positive response in the system to say, well, there are other people who are already outside, and so if I can at least get enough people to question it on the inside, then maybe that's what my role is. At the same time, I think I should tell you that my Catholicism was changing quite rapidly over this period. I don't think I ever stopped going to church, but I had a time when I was trying to figure out when did Jesus understand he was God. And I think in my red, white, and blue Jesus was simply God. And it was very hard to relate to a human Jesus. Because if he was human, then he cried and bled, all of those things, and that he really lived in the same trying circumstances as I was living in. That there was, and if he didn't, then the whole thing was probably a sham. And I dealt with that with a priest and some other people, and it's perhaps the wrong question to ask, but it is a place at least where one can start to make some inquiry and decide for oneself, maybe for the first time, what is this religion all about? And if this Jesus was really a human and God, perhaps he comes in a few shades other than red, white, and blue or other combinations. And maybe not only our involvement with the Vietnamese, but our whole relationship with communist nations is flawed. That we are, or I am, anti-communist because I've been taught to be, and I am not anti-communist because I don't like them, or because I've ever thought about it. And that maybe they are real people after all. I went back to sea on the Forrestal as chief engineer for about 2.5 years. Had some interesting experiences there dealing with people. And the people, of course, are all active duty Navy, most of them enlisted. I had roughly, well, anywhere from, say, 700 to 750 people working for me. And as I shared with you earlier, some of them not too bright, and some of them incredibly smart. Had 19-year-olds standing top watch in main spaces, running the whole machinery plant, that, and had 35-year-olds who couldn't begin to do it. That variation in skill and in aptitude for the work. And we had some people in the Navy at the time who simply weren't very bright. And some of them incredibly good-hearted people. That therefore they could be abused. It was easy to accuse them of something. If something broke, it was that guy's fault. And that guy would generally accept blame because that was the only way he could be part of the group. he couldn't be a real contributing member of the community because he could do something good. He could be by taking the blame for something having gone wrong. And I observed this a few times, and I said, you know, got the people together over it to explain, this is bad business. Can't have this. Somebody, if the responsible people have to take the responsibility. If we can always find someone to blame, we can't get anywhere. But that led to some other thinking on it. I mean, if we can blame commies for our problems, if we can blame anybody other than ourselves, we're in trouble. That led to a whole lot of discussion on the ship, is that where do we take our responsibilities? What are we about?
We're probably dragging this out far too long.
Why don't you focus a little bit on how you've moved since then, and why you, I want to have some chance for questions. Obviously you've moved.
I think it's probably after that I came out here to a job that was in the Puget Sound shipyard, but I was in charge of planning overhauls for aircraft carriers. And after 3 years in that job, I retired. Again, and during that period, and with the people that I worked, or with whom I worked, the same kind of thing, that we've got to be responsible. A lot of what Steve was saying is that we can't pass blame off. We have to be responsible for what you're doing in this job right now, and do that well. And if you can't, if you have questions about it, then we can talk. But unless you're prepared to do it well and are trying to do it well, then there's real trouble. I retired from the Navy. I didn't have a job. I worked for a while with school board, with a church, and then I went back. I took a job with a defense contractor, doing a lot of the same stuff I had been doing before, except now I didn't have any responsibility and I got paid more. there's something wrong with that. I will have to admit that that's it. And again, it was interesting because it was another workplace in the defense establishment. Again, with good people. And we could talk about issues. I think I started talking more and more about anti-nuclear weapons. I probably had picked up along the way an abhorrence of them. And it's a real deep-seated thing with me. A nuclear weapon, on my terms at least, breaks every rule of war. If there is any nobility to the military tradition, it's dishonored by a nuclear weapon. That has to do mostly with the indiscriminate nature of how they work. That non-combatants are killed. The only reason to have war is to save non-combatants, if you will. There is certainly a time and a place and a sense of war, but if everybody's dead at the end of it, there's something very wrong with the idea of getting into it, all the weapons that would be used to get us there. So I moved from that kind of opposition to nuclear weapons, somewhat general, to active protesting nuclear weapons, to Bangor, and we started one peace group in Port Orchard or in Kitsap County,
And eventually, I joined an organization in the 6th Congressional District called Sixth Sense early on. Both of these organizations have to do originally with straight opposition to nuclear weapons. That was their genesis. That's what they dealt with. The one in Kitsap County had a fairly lively year and a half active engagement with the community, and then the membership started to wane. And in the Sixth Sense community, we had, by the time Reagan was reelected in 84, we had a pretty good idea that we could not go any place further opposing nuclear weapons. It simply is, something else is at work in why we are not getting any more converts to it. Shortly thereafter, I met Steve. We did some work together in a organization. It was a Lawyers Alliance to oppose nuclear weapons. Interesting group of people, because it wasn't just lawyers, but it was to establish a legal framework for nuclear weapons. Without going into all of the details of it, we found only one place where they're legal. That would be low-yield weapons used at sea between two combatant ships. And that would be the only place that nuclear weapons could fit into the legal framework established by all of our international obligations, all of the treaties we'd ratified.
Tom, I'm feeling, I have my eye on the watch, and I'm wanting you to go into some detail on this, but also realizing that there are different pieces of your story that people may want to ask about.
Let me wrap it up then.
Yeah, okay.
It comes down to right now, who is responsible to prevent war? And if I can't answer that question, I am. We are all in trouble. I do not want to hear anybody say to me, they are, or the Defense Department is, because I don't know what you're talking about. When it comes down to who is responsible to prevent war, I am.
Well, let's open it up for questions, responses.
So the bottom line is to use the first school bus analogy, the trick is getting on the bus and teaching everybody there how to drive.
That's right. I mean, why didn't the brakes work? Somebody wasn't doing their job. Someone didn't take the responsibility to do their job right to prevent the disaster.
Tom, and this is very hypothetical and probably very difficult to answer, but if you were now at the same point in your views, but in your 10th year in the Navy, would you stay in the Navy?
I think I would test the waters some, a whole lot more than I did. I would not get out immediately. I think I have to imagine a little of the hypothetical situation that I'm suddenly thrust in, and now what do I do? There I have 10 years service, 10 years more, and I could retire. I have 10 years experience. How am I relating to the people around me? And if I know what I know right now, and I got the response that was that I could expect. I would have to get up. I don't think there's any question about it anymore in my mind. And that has to do with the mentality that's at work in the military, that the military is responsible for the prevention of war. Now, and they have it because the rest of us have given it to them and said, here's the big problem, you folks solve it. Well, they're trying to solve it. And now the folks are saying, we don't like the way you're solving it, do it another way. They're not saying, that's my job, is to prevent the war. So we're asking the military to do something that is, on my terms, impossible. We're asking them to get actively involved in preventing war, in building weapons that prevent war. And I'm concerned that the weapons won't do war if we have to have war. That's the same kind of thing that Steve is talking about. See, that it's a very real problem. Too many Americans have pushed the whole thing over to the military. Lots of parts of the military are only too happy to take it because there's money that's being made there. It's the lobbyist question. I think that we can make much better ground with, to answer your question, if I go out into the community and I'm able to convince people to be responsible themselves.
You had said earlier that in your efforts to get organizations, get your organization going, to get more support for taking responsibility, that you ran into something. It didn't mushroom the way you expected it to. Is what you ran into this refusal to take individual responsibility?
No.
Or what,
no.
What did you run into?
We ran into, and I'm sorting it out, so this is not an answer, it's a, where am I in this journey? When we found out we weren't making progress protesting, if you will, the negative side of the campaign, we looked for why we're not doing it, why we weren't having more success. We think it's because we advocate reduction of armament, reduce the military spending, and to too many people, that's taking away their job. Now, it's not necessarily the same in some other communities, but if I'm working in Kitsap County or in the 6th Congressional District, there is a whole lot of employment that comes directly from military budget. The employment work job is awfully close to our hearts. We say a lot of things and we've written down a lot of things as principles, the red, white, and blue principles. The way they're carried out is more and more becoming evident to me. The way they're carried out is that we serve each other with our work. Now, when we put it into practice, we're doing it with a job. And this, as I said earlier, it's a hard spot with me between the job and the work, but the job is what counts. And so we accord dignity to individuals based on their job, and we award financial security based on the job. Well, that's just too much for a person to walk away from. Simply, I'm not sure Jesus the human, you know, that it would take Jesus to walk away from it in Tacoma today, or in
In Tom, Florida that's part today. Of my wrestling. It's very much a part of my wrestling. They pay me well for what I do, you know, I mean.
And it's tough, and it's not just the pay, it's both things. It's the dignity and the pay are combined in the job. And to threaten the person's job, that person can't get in, person has to walk away. So we're working much more now on creating jobs that are not funded by the military. And I think that has to do with how do we prevent war? Because we have jobs, hopefully work, that are not funded by the military, that there is a reasonable alternative, and we turn over to the civilians or the non-military a whole lot of what's military now involved in prevention of war. I mean, the best weapon we'd have would be 50,000 people going for a tour of the Soviet Union. I mean, we can't have war in the Soviet Union if we have 50,000 people there and they have 50,000 here.
We are not going to resolve the issues related to defense industry and nuclear arms race tonight. It's 20 of Barry, can we take another 3 minutes or so? I have a closing question, or should we stop here?
Sure, I'll say so, but I don't have 3 minutes.
Yeah. I would like to finish by asking each person to think about what your learnings are from tonight, where you've been stretching, and what your questions are. Because there's been a lot of different information, feelings expressed. And we certainly can't have everybody express what their questions are as they leave tonight, but I would like to have a few questions, whether they're questions about weapon systems and trying to understand that, or questions about theology. What are your questions that you leave tonight with?
One question that hasn't been touched on is the fact that perhaps we in the Soviet Union, neither of us won war, but supposing somebody else in some remote place like Libya or some other country decides to drop the bomb.
No answers at the moment, just questions.
My question would be, to further, I guess, what you were closing up saying, Tom, is how do we work toward creating truly a peace economy where more than 50% of our tax dollars are going toward the promotion of life and health and not the destruction of life, even if that's other people's lives. So how do we create jobs? How do we rebuild? Not rebuild, that's a little major, but how do we create jobs and work toward a system that is really truly a peace economy and away from a war economy?
I guess a couple questions. One about, I really like that image of the red, white, and blue Jesus. How do we destroy that fallacy? And so that would be a question. Another one is, I guess I'm still having some difficulty with Steve in hearing him talk about this tension, but I'm wondering more about the spiritual dimension of how his faith really rubs with those decisions that are being made.
My question is still the same one I came here with, you know. Is God calling me to pursue the path that I'm in presently? Or is God calling me out of it?
And I'll add to that, how do you know?
Yeah.
Well, I'm interested. One of my questions from this weekend is within my work of working with the ministry of the laity and churches, am I called to focus on the ministry of people who are in the defense industry. Is that one of my, should, am I called to focus on that in the next few years? I don't know the answer to that. I guess another question in my mind is most of us are going to be out of, those of us who are at Holden Village now are going to be out of Holden Village in churches with people in the defense industry. And what does this evening have, how has this evening influenced you in terms of being perhaps different than you might have been? I want to thank both of you. And tomorrow morning we will gather here at 9 o'clock to look at all of our situations in different workplaces that we've been in. What are some of the opportunities that we've had in those situations for faithfulness? We've already taken a beginning look at that. But also, what do you do when you wrestle with some really tough issues? And we're going to take a look at what some of the tough issues can be, and how do you wrestle faithfully with those. I look forward to seeing you here. And have a good snack. That's what's up next. Is that not right?
Great. Thank you.
Yeah.